Hello, and welcome to the third of a four-part series about liberty and security. This panel discussion was held on March 21, 2002, in Willimantic, Connecticut. It was sponsored by the Northeast Connecticut Green Party. The event was a public forum on the state of civil liberties in the wake of the USA Patriot Act and the ongoing war on terrorism. Speakers were asked to address these issues as they relate to constitutional rights and their effects on Latino immigrants, Arab Americans, and social justice activists.
Our last speaker is attorney Jerome Pound. He is a solo lawyer with an office in Willimantic and serves as the general counsel for the Greater Northeastern Joint Board of the former Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union and its successor, the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial and Textile Employees. In Connecticut, he represents workers in labor and employment law matters and defends people accused in criminal matters. Mr. Pound is the treasurer of the National Lawyers Guild since 1999, has served as co-chair of the Guild's Labor and Employment Committee, and has been a Guild member for over 25 years.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here to speak with you. Of course, it's my daunting task now to follow such a panel of distinguished speakers that, one could ask, what is there left for me to say? After hearing the stories. But I did lean over to Raphael earlier when he told me he'd gotten arrested in Vieques, and I said to him, well, you're probably a terrorist. And the reason I said that was, and I think he was lucky he got arrested before the USA Patriot Act went into effect, because under Section 802, which you heard recited to you earlier, and the definition of domestic terrorism, what do you got to do to be a domestic terrorist? Sounds like you don't have to do much. You have to engage in some sort of criminal behavior, from what I take it. Any criminal behavior will do. You know, Raphael was probably trespassing on government land, so that probably qualifies as a criminal act. And he was probably doing it, my guess is, to influence the policy, or at least I'm sure he appeared to be looking like he was intending to influence the policy of our government. Well, that certainly fits the other prong of that definition. So I think under the definition of domestic terrorism, you're looking at a bona fide terrorist here. Congratulations. But it wouldn't be just Raphael. Do you remember the sit-in strikers who sat in at lunch counters in 15 states in the South to desegregate those Jim Crow states and dismantle the segregation that existed in this country? Remember those guys? Well, you know, they were trespassing. And, you know, by going in, I did leave out one of the other elements. Probably Raphael was guilty of this as well. But those sit-in demonstrators, they were certainly guilty of this, because one of the definitions that you have to be worried about here is that part of your action may endanger civilian lives. It doesn't say whose life, and it doesn't say who has to perpetrate the violence. So, you know, those sit-in demonstrators who might have gotten hit by the police with clubs and batons when they had to be removed from those premises, they were endangering, if nobody else, their own lives. They were breaking a law, trespassing, and they were probably doing it again, certainly appeared to be doing it with the intention of influencing a government policy. And I take it that would make them domestic terrorists under the USA Patriot Act. I don't know about you, but I'm scared, quite frankly. This is a terrifying set of events. Now, you've heard a lot of other things that people have said here about different experiences they've had, and you've heard some generalities about the law and some of the things that this act does, I'm going to try and become a little bit more specific and speak mostly about how this act affects activists. Before the enactment of this act, I might have stood up and asked you, how many here are engaged in social activism and are doing activist activity? Raise your hands, please, so I'd have an idea. No, don't do that tonight. No. I said before the act, I would have asked that question. I don't ask that question now. Because that's a dangerous thing to be engaging in, you know? Because under this act, you don't really have to be suspected of anything, you see, in order to be surveilled. If the government has a reason to believe, under Section 216, I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about Section 216 of the Act. It's a wonderful section of the Act. That authorizes surveillance of internet usage. And what you have to do in order to get an order, if you're the government, to surveil somebody's internet usage, is to establish that, to certify to a court, that you need the order to surveil the internet usage because you are engaged in activity that, quote, is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation, unquote. There's no limitation as to what kind of investigation you're talking about. I take it, once again, any criminal investigation will do. But, you know, if they want to surveil me, I don't have to be the suspect. I don't have to be the target. I don't have to be involved. All I have to be doing is being suspected of being involved in some activity that may be relevant, might not be, but it may be relevant to their investigation. And then they can surveil the usage. Now, how do they do this? They can do it by placing taps and traps on your internet use. Well, you say, well, you know, so what? They tap Pound's phone, you know, big deal. Much more insidious than that. The government has a new tool many of you may have heard of, maybe you haven't, but it's called Carnivore. Carnivore is a wonderful program that the government has come up with. It's a software program. What Carnivore does is it monitors and tracks internet messages, email, usage of web pages, and can sort this stuff. Again, you might say, well, so they're going to do this to Pound's telephone. Oh, no, not so simple. Because Carnivore doesn't get installed on my telephone. It gets installed on the ISP, my internet service provider. And Carnivore, it's a good name for this thing, devours all of the information that passes through that ISP. Now, the FBI and federal government, you know, we should all feel secure because they have assured that they have filters that will ensure that no human eyes will see the content of any email or any web pages that they're not supposed to look at. And I don't know about you, but I certainly feel much more secure knowing that they have those filters. But that being said, nobody has actually verified that these filters work. So we don't know that what they claim they can filter, they can in fact filter. And I won't even bore you with the details about how it's very difficult to filter these things, because unlike a telephone conversation where, you know, dialing instructions go through the net, the telephone lines, and then after that you can tell when the conversation occurs, because of the way digital information is transferred in packets, content gets mixed with address all the time. And there also becomes issues about, well, if they're checking what web pages I'm reading and they know what web pages I'm looking at, are they in fact getting to my content? There's certainly an argument about that, I would think. So it's a very difficult and dangerous situation that we're heading down on this road. And there really isn't a court check on this, because the court has to issue the order once the government agent certifies that, in fact, you know, this information may be relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. That's all that's required. So there is no probable cause standard, and indeed, since I'm not a target, they're not going to arrest me necessarily, at least not, that's not the initial idea. I really am not entitled to any protection at that particular point in time. It's very dangerous kinds of invasions of privacy here, invasions of search and seizure, and perhaps not invasions, but certainly excuses to get around the search and seizure protections of the Fourth Amendment. For activists, and again, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, so please don't, but those of you who may be engaged in activity, you may use the internet, you may send email to some of your fellow activists, be forewarned, you may be doing things that may be relevant to a criminal investigation. So activists have to be very careful about how they proceed and what they do in this climate. And like Raphael, I'm very skeptical and dubious about the courts. I don't share the view that the courts are going to protect us and that they may find these things unconstitutional. One would have thought, perhaps, or hoped at least, that the Supreme Court, if it had reviewed the internment of Japanese Americans by an executive order, would have said that, oh no, this is unconstitutional. Well, they did review in 1944 those executive orders in a case called Karamatsu versus the United States, and in their wisdom decided that those internments were in fact okay, because it was not, the court was not going to try and second-guess the executive branch at a time of quote-unquote national emergency. So I have little faith that the courts in any kind of speedy fashion or even long-term fashion are likely to protect our democratic rights. And if anybody has any doubt about this and the way the court functions, I would encourage you to take a look at the court decision in, you know, the presidential selection case. Because if there was ever any case that makes it transparent about how our Supreme Court decides cases and whether or not they're politically motivated, I would submit to you, after reading that case, there can be no question that the court acts in a political fashion. And this court is not about protecting individual civil liberties and civil rights. So I don't think that the courts are going to be protecting us. And I don't think we can count on the federal agencies to stay within the law. They've demonstrated over and over and over again their disdain for doing that. And now everything, as near as I can tell, I haven't read all 342 pages of the Patriot Act, but, you know, I'm in good company because none of the senators, I don't think, have, and I'm reasonably certain none of the Congress people have either. So I shouldn't be an exception, I suppose. But that act contains most of the things and most of the abuses that were found to be illegal under the COINTELPRO operations that the government used illegally to stifle dissent during the civil rights and Vietnam era simply because people were trying to exercise First Amendment rights. So I would encourage you not to trust the courts. I would encourage you, however, to stay on the streets. I would encourage you to talk to people who you wouldn't normally talk to about these things, because you might be surprised when they find out what's going on, how they'll react. We have to broaden and take this battle to the streets, to the people, so that the political will of the people can be preserved. I'll just close by reminding people that Senator Huey Long, back in the 1930s from Louisiana, said, and I paraphrase here, that if fascism ever comes to the United States, it will come wrapped in the American flag. So I would submit to you, now is indeed a time to be vigilant. Thank you.
You are listening to a panel discussion on civil liberties following the September 11th calamity. The event took place in Willimantic, Connecticut on March 21st, 2002. After the panelists concluded their presentations, the floor was open to questions from the audience.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for speaking. And we're going to open it up now to question and answers. So we're setting up microphones right over here. If you do want to ask a question but you don't want to be recorded, there's little pads of paper outside on the table. You can write it down, and you can pass it to David Nelson, who's sneaking up behind me right now, or myself, and we will ask the question for you. So the question I wanted to ask was of Jerome Pound, and in a conversation previously, you had mentioned something that's happening in Utah, legislation that might create a crime called commercial terrorism, which is very interesting. And I just sort of wanted to ask you if you could just kind of explain that a little bit more.
Yes. I just learned of this last night when I was downloading email. Probably lots of other people in the government have learned about it as a result of that download now. Apparently, the Judiciary Committee in the state of Utah, the legislature there, has reported out favorably on a bill that creates not domestic terrorism, as we know and love it under the USA Patriot Act, but a new brand of terrorism called commercial terrorism. And commercial terrorism is interesting because I'm trying to find the exact definition of it here, but commercial terrorism, as defined, I guess, in Utah, involves criminal activity by criminal elements, of course, but not for pecuniary benefit on their own part, but really criminal activity that in one way or another adversely affects or injures business interests, you see. It's a very important thing to protect, you know. And I take it, you know, that had Utah been thought of this 30 years ago, they really could have had quite a bit of impact on any of the desegregation boycotts and activity aimed at trying to persuade business people to desegregate their institutions. Here it is. I've now found it. Thank you very much. Here we go. Commercial terrorism, which would make it a felony to enter or remain unlawfully on the premises, that's basically trespass, right, or in a building of any business with the intent to interfere with the employees, watch out, labor unions, customers, personnel, or operations of the business. So, there you have it. That's commercial terrorism in the state of Utah. Now, I will say this bill, I don't know that the actual legislature has voted on this or even had hearings on it, but, you know, they don't really need to have hearings on it. Congress didn't with the Patriot Act.
If that is true, then what about universities and high schools and junior high schools being maybe infiltrated the curricula by the military? Does anybody know the answer? I heard that one of the radio advertisements for this meeting today was that the military was somehow in need of disclosing their financing and or infiltration into the universities and schools somehow. Is that?
Well, I just want to answer real quickly. You have to remember in the definition of any of these, both on the Utah, the state proposal and the federal proposal, is a unit of government. And that goes down, all the way down to school boards.
Schools, yes.
Schools.
That's what I was wondering, because is a school then a business that's being infiltrated by?
Well, the privatization of schools.
They would be committing a heresy under their own law.
Well, if I just quickly address that by saying that I've been in the National Lawyers Guild for a long time, and one of the things that distinguishes the National Lawyers Guild from many other organizations, particularly legal organizations, is that the Attorney General back during the McCarthy era tried to blacklist us by naming us as legal arm of the CPUSA at that time. But thereafter, we were COINTELPRO'd. We found out in the 1970s when we sued the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And we were infiltrated for nothing more than, you know, protecting and advocating the protection of people's rights. Certainly, many groups have been infiltrated. The history of the 60s and 70s is replete with instances of police agent provocateurs who actually brought about activity so that they could persecute and arrest people for engaging in the activity that the agent provocateurs encouraged them to engage in. So is it possible? Well, if you're asking me, I would certainly say it's not only possible, it's entirely likely.
Can I add something to that? There's an interesting section in the Patriotic Act that I call my attention. I think it's 507, and it has to do with schools, because what this section does, it allows the government to get an ex parte order to have access to the academic records of anyone who could be under suspicion of terrorism or in some way connected to that. But the interesting part, the really interesting part, is not that they can just go and get an order and you are not notified, but it's the fact that once they get your academic records, it becomes their property. And they can disseminate that to anyone, including the military, including the FBI, the CIA, whoever they want, because it lacks a – once they access your academic records, there's no further judicial supervision. So the act itself has some well-designed mechanisms in which they can access information about you. You would not know about it, and then it could be spread around to the Navy, to the Air Force, to whoever, to the CIA, and so forth. So those are ways in which they are intruding into the academic and school fields.
Another thing that might be important to keep in mind is it may not directly point to address your point, but the Church Committee report and the Pike Committee report, I don't think ever came out, but the Church Committee report was released, and I'm talking about a Senator Church. This is late 70s, after Watergate. These committees investigated how these things happen and what's going on with FBI and CIA and all of those things. So the Church Committee report was released, and I forget the numbers and everything, but there were like hundreds of faculty members in universities all across the United States who were actually CIA employees or CIA paid people, and their job was actually to internally, not externally, not outside of the United States, but actually inside of the United States, to do propaganda for the CIA, write books, and all of those kinds of activities. And this was a good 25 years ago that this report was released. So that's something else to keep in mind. This was the CIA, which really has no business trying to influence people within the United States. So it's something else to keep in mind.
And Secretary of State Ashcroft has gone so far as to ask that they loosen the restrictions and allow for the FBI, CIA, INS to go into locations such as churches, mosques, temples, etc., and monitor First Amendment activity. Much of what took place in the 1960s and 70s during the Civil Rights Movement is being asked that those laws that were put in place, those restrictions that were put in place, be removed during this time of national crisis.
I'm an organizer, not a questioner, and I just want to point out a couple of things. One thing we thought here, that getting you folks here tonight just to listen would not be enough. We'd like to see you all take some action, and we have a couple of little actions that you can take. We have one petition, which is just going to be delivered to our representatives. You have to read that, and we encourage you to sign it. The other sheet is signifying, if you want to, your willingness to join us at a meeting with our representative and or senators. We'll try to schedule it at a time when you can go, like a Saturday. But if you put your name down there and your phone number, we will definitely call you when we set up a meeting with the rep. Thirdly, any of you who do these things or don't do these things, please write a letter to your congressman. You know, letters from a lot of people will get their attention. So please pay attention to all these things as we pass them around. Thank you.
I have a written question. Apparently, I'm told that in the 1970s there was a bill called Senate Bill 1, which seemed to be related to the Patriot Act, and that it was very repressive. Does anyone know the relationship between the Patriot Act and Senate Bill 1 of the 1970s?
The only thing I can say is that, you know, each session of Congress starts renumbering their bills. So the 70s is an entire decade. There were probably more than one Senate Bill 1.
Indeed.
And so I don't really know what it's referring to. But certainly the Patriot Act, as I think was pointed out earlier tonight, I mean, it doesn't really contain anything new. These are all old ideas that have been circulated, surfaced, used either legally or illegally, with various effects over the years by the federal government and federal agencies. What's new about it is now that they've jammed it all together in one act and managed to get it passed with hurrahs from Congress in such record time and with so little review. But, you know, there's nothing in the act especially that is brand new and that those of us who have been engaged in social activism hasn't seen before.
So concludes this part of a series on liberty and security after the September 11th calamity. Please tune in again for the conclusion of this series. This program was produced by George King at the studios of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. Sound engineering was by John Schwenk. The music used in this program was composed by Dominic Muldowney. Thanks for listening.